You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
DraftKings.com. If you're into sports, if you like fantasy sports, fantasy baseball is back. And guess what? You can win big money with DraftKings.com. Let me give you an example. Last year, a guy named James Tran won $1 million in one day. Okay? You can play for free. You can win. You can actually win real cash. You enter Callen, C-A-L-L-E-N, at DraftKings.com. You get a free entry to play opening day and over $500,000 in cash prizes. This is basically you. You get to put your money where your mouth is. You get to actually see if you know what you're doing when it comes to fantasy baseball, and you can win money based on your guesses and your estimates, all right? So enter Callen now at DraftKings.com. DraftKings.com. You can make money, and by the way, it's a lot of fun. Now back to the podcast. All right, this is the Brian Callen Show, and I'm with my colleague Hunter Motz, of course, as always. And our guest that Hunter found, yeah, see, I don't know what I'd do without you, Hunter, because we have Jerry Coyne, Professor Jerry Coyne, who wrote a book called Why Evolution is True. And I got to tell you, we read a lot of books on this podcast because we have a lot of authors, but, you know, there's a tendency to try to skip sections. Well, I know this side. I couldn't skip any of it because it just became more and more fascinating. And I have to tell you, I consider myself an educated guy. Didn't know how evolution really worked. I had the broad, general, broad strokes. But I have to say, it's such an important book. Everybody should have to read it. So, Professor Coyne, thanks for writing this book. And
yeah,
that's
very flattering of you. You're not alone in not knowing how evolution works. It's not taught very well anywhere. And if you get to college without having taken it in high school, you're not going to really get it in a formal educational setting. So that's one reason I wrote the book, in fact. So.
Yeah. Well, it's great. Well, because what it starts with, and I you know, I appreciate very much, is the fact that you're mad, you're angry, and well should be, at superstitious thought. And it is not, ignorance is not bliss, ignorance is harmful. And I've always used this example. You know, somebody defines themselves on what they're willing to fight for. And if you know, people say, well, you know, we live in a time when political commitment isn't so important. And, you know, well, listen, that's fine until somebody, a school board, wants to teach your children creative design. Or intelligent design.
It should be called creative design.
Yeah, or whatever it is.
Yeah, it is creationism.
Yeah, and well, that's their right. No, and I love the way you basically say what you break down is evolution is a theory, but a scientific theory, which is very different than saying, well, I have a theory about why that works. No, in fact, it's a theory the way the theory of gravity works, the theory atomic theory. It's a very different thing. So maybe you could explain that to us for a second.
Yeah, well, in common parlance, the way most people think of a theory is as sort of a guess or an unsupported speculation. The example I like to use, because I live in Chicago, is, you know, my theory is that the Cubs are going to win the World Series this year.
Good luck, bro. Good
that's
luck.
That's as close to an unsupported speculation as you can get. Or, you know, my theory is that John will ask you out if you're talking to a woman or something like that.
Right.
But so it's just, you know, speculation. But people have taken that to mean to the scientific realm, and yet when scientists speak of theories, as I mentioned in the book and you mentioned them, we mean something very different from an idle speculation or guess. It's
but I should interrupt you for a second, because
yeah,
when you say people, when you say people have said that, it's not just people, it's politicians like Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, Reagan has used that. I mean, I think in 1980 he said something like, "Will, it's theory of evolution it's only a theory, you know, and could be wrong."
Yeah.
And of course, that resonated with a lot of his benighted minions who agreed with him. But he was using the theory there in the common sense, you know, a guess or speculation. And that's what a lot of people think. And that's, in fact, the most common, or one of the most common misconceptions about evolution, is that it's only a theory, with theory meaning speculation or guess. The scientific meaning, as you intimated, is that it is an explanatory framework consisting of a group of propositions meant to account for natural phenomena. So we have the germ theory of disease, that infectious diseases are caused by microorganisms. Now we know they're viruses and bacteria and protozoans. That the theory of gravity, and we still don't know exactly how it works, but we know, you know, enough to be able to predict how it will influence bodies. And we have the atomic theory, which is that matter is made up of little particles called atoms, that are the indivisible chemical units of matter. And those things are all explanatory frameworks which are meant to account for a diversity of phenomena, and they're well supported by the data, and they're supported to the extent that, you know, the germ theory and the atomic theory can be regarded as true theories. That is, they right. explain things correctly, and that's the same with the theory of evolution.
Well, one of the things that I found is that, that's right, as you gain more and more data to support this theory, it becomes true. I don't think anybody wants to argue with the fact that there are atoms exist. We've already proven it with microscopes, I think in the 80s, as you mentioned. The theory of gravity, good luck trying to disprove that, et cetera. And one of the things that I really love about the book is that science, and as we learn more about gene sequencing, the genome, and all these things that the new frontiers of science, the theory of evolution is being more supported. It is not being, it's not, you're not taking away from it. There are missing holes, but for the most part, evolution is being proven. There's just way more evidence to suggest that everything that Darwin came up with is, in fact, 100% true.
Well, pretty much. I mean, Darwin got a few things wrong, more than a few, actually. You know, his theory of genetics was wonky because, you know, although Mendel had figured it out in Darwin's time, that news hadn't reached Darwin, so Darwin had to confect his own sort of wonky theory. So that's not right. But in the main, I mean, Darwin's what I call his big five propositions, you know, evolution, gradualism, natural selection, common ancestry, and I can't remember the other one right now.
And speciation, I think.
And speciation, sorry, lineage splitting, which is the reverse side of the coin of common ancestry, that you start off with one life form way, way back, and it splits over and over and over again until you get the 7 million species we have on Earth today. All those five propositions have been proven true. And the evidence is so strong that we don't really need to go out and look for it anymore. It's like looking at, you know, another piece of matter and saying, well, maybe are there really atoms in this one?
Right.
Well, we have enough experience to know that's the case, and we really don't need to go looking for evidence for evolution. And people really don't anymore. You couldn't publish a paper on, you know, more evidence for evolution, but we could figure out, you know, how it works, what species are more closely related to other species, you know, some of the mechanisms, which, as you say, we don't understand everything about. There's still a lot of research to be done, but the main outlines of the theory, those five propositions that, in fact, were suggested by Darwin, are true. I mean, true,
yeah, well,
in the scientific sense, well, but we could still find some data that would show them to be wrong, but I would bet my fortune, small as it is, on the fact that it's not going to be found wrong.
Well, that's the other thing about, like you say, with the Supreme Court justice who said, I don't know how to define pornography, but I know it when I see it. And Plato's the theory of the forms, where you may not be able to ever draw a perfect triangle or draw a perfect circle or draw or even see a perfect horse, but you can imagine it based on previous forms. So you can imagine, so in other words, you'll never be a perfect human being, you'll never be perfectly virtuous, but you can imagine what perfect virtue would be, and that's the important point. So there is a bar and a truism that exists without having to actually touch, see, or feel it.
You're talking about truth, you know, being when.
Well, I'm just using. I'm bringing the, because I'm so smart. I'm bridging science over, even with our concepts of what is true and what is false, and
yeah,
what you can hang your hat on, you know.
But you can also make it simpler in terms of what Professor Coyne is saying, which is, I've seen things fall down often enough that I don't walk around in doubt that at some point things will fall upwards.
Yeah,
you know what
right.
I mean? It's the same thing. At a certain point, there's just such a preponderance of evidence that, you know, we can take it for granted.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, that's the Steve Gould's definition of truth, that he proposed before he died, that it is something that is so well established that it would be perverse to withhold your provisional assent. I mean, that's a long-winded way of saying you'd bet on it.
Yeah.
I mean, and that's Anthony Grayling, the philosopher's definition of proof, by the way. People say scientists can't prove anything, and that's really true in a formal sense. We can't. We're not logicians, and we're not mathematicians, so we can't prove things so we can prove the Pythagorean theorem. There's always a chance, however small, that what we've shown can be disproven, but we can't. So that means we can't absolutely establish everything as proof. But, you know,
my issue with all that is that, in fact, you can. In fact, I use a cell phone every day. I fly in a plane. I go to the doctor. I get a CAT scan, whatever it might be. The science that saves my life, that allows me to talk to somebody 5,000 miles away in real time, that allows me to watch TV, that allows me to fly in a 50-ton, whatever it is, plane, those principles of science are the same principles of science many times that are used to explain phenomena like evolution, et cetera, et cetera. So it always seems like the height of hypocrisy to use and benefit from and trust one form of technology that uses scientific principles, and then to reject the other based on a feeling, an emotion, a faith.
Yeah, I mean, that really is hypocritical. Because creationists, of course, fly in planes, and they don't have a problem with aerodynamics or hydrodynamics. They have a problem with evolution. But, of course, the problem is that evolution is the one area of science, with the possible exception of, you know, climate change, that really strikes at the heart of religious belief. And that's why 46% of Americans reject the theory of evolution completely.
46%?
Yeah, well, so there's a Gallup poll taken in last year, in the end of 2013, and these are the statistics. So I think it was like 40. So they asked people how humans came to be, and one of the alternatives was humans were created in the last 10,000 years by God. They appeared suddenly. And that 46% of the people surveyed agreed with that, and that's basically young earth creationism for humans. And that figure has held pretty steady between 40 and 46% for the past 30-odd years. The other alternative was evolution happened, but God guided it, which we call theistic evolution, that God made certain mutations or tweaked things, or maybe put a soul in the human lineage, which the Catholic Church believes, or maybe let everything else evolve in a Darwinian fashion, but humans were created specially. Those are all forms of theistic evolution, and those were accepted by 30% of the American public.
Well, but that's where I think, and that's probably why evolution has always been so almost insulting to human beings. I mean, you talk a little bit about how materialistic it is.
Yeah.
When you get into it, they get into the brutality of it, just how imperfect it is, first of all, etc. How do you explain, and do you ever think about the fact that human beings are romantic, are conscious, do seem to have something other than something different than do primates or any other animal, which is the idea of potential, imagination, the need to go beyond and to continue to understand not only the world around it but the world but itself. We really do want to know ourselves, and we are awed and we are inspired. Those are pretty amazing. Those are pretty amazing. I mean, when you look at Beethoven and Shakespeare and Mozart, and the list goes on, the artistic expression that no animal is even in the same universe as this bipedal ape, called human. So, how do you explain that? What do you think?
Well, I mean, there's two. You're sort of talking about two different phenomena. One of which is how do humans stand apart in their biology from the rest of the species on Earth. And you're right, we have this thing called culture, which is the result of our big brains, which gave us the ability to reason, to think about what other people were thinking, gave us all kinds of potentials that were not envisioned or produced by evolution, but were sort of epiphenomena.
Yeah.
So, we weren't selected for our ability to play chess or build submarines or airplanes or anything like that. It's a byproduct of our cerebrum. And that does make us stand apart. What really, to my mind, makes us stand apart from other species is the use of symbolic language, which I think is the one behavior humans have that's uniquely human. I mean, apes and other species can use tools, for example. So, and they can also look at, they can also have what we call the intentional stance. They can envision what's going on in the mind of some other animals. So, for example, a scrub jay, it hides its acorns and holds it holes of trees, but if it sees another scrub jay watching it, it will leave, but it'll come back and remove the acorns and hide them somewhere else. And what that means is that bird is really thinking, okay, that other bird is watching me and he's going to steal my acorns, right? And I'm going to have to, and that's, you know, that's a pretty advanced form of cognition.
Yeah.
So when
yeah.
you think of what's truly human, and, you know, tool using is just, I mean, submarines and airplanes and things like that, those are all just extremely refined
tools.
Results of tool using and technology, which animals have. Crows have it, primates have it and stuff. But symbolic language is something that's absolutely unique to humans. And
explain what that means.
Well, that means that we can manipulate symbols in a unique way. We can put them together to make novel, you know, meanings, novel concepts in a way that no other animal can. I mean, you can teach maybe an ape to say cup and drink, but you couldn't teach an ape to put, you know, symbols together to convey thought processes or anything like that, in a unique way. And that's sort of uniquely human. Now, that doesn't mean that, and this is the other thing I wanted to say, is that doesn't imply that there's anything non-materialistic about our biology, or that there's some spirit or something metaphysical infused in us that enables us to be different. It's purely a materialistic process. It's just that evolution has bestowed us these cerebral capacities, and everything else comes from that. So,
Well, and I think one of the things that thought was interesting is, you know, Brian was saying that, you know, evolution seems to be uniquely something that drives religious people up the wall. But, you know, Patricia Farah in her book about Newton talks about how upset religious scholars were by the idea of gravity. It actually was a huge, huge controversy in the 18th century because the idea was that, you know, that God had created the universe and left it to run on its own without directly intervening and being mm-hmm. responsible for the movement of each celestial body mm-hmm. was offensive to them. You know, they thought that God had a hand in all things. So, I mean, you know, this is a recurring thing is that, you know, as we understand how the universe works, it challenges how religious people have thought the universe worked.
Well, just people in general.
Exactly.
Because, I mean, this, if you have 46%, which is, you know, an unbelievable number, especially at a time where we have such understanding. I mean,
it's not only that. I mean, if you add to that 46%, it's the 30-odd% that believe in theistic evolution, which is a non-scientific belief. I mean, we evolutionists do not think that God has intervened in the process of evolution and made mutations, put souls in, and has directed the thing. It's a purely materialistic process. And when you add those up, it's close to 80%. If you look at the proportion of Americans who really accept evolution the way we scientists do, as a purely naturalistic, unguided, materialistic process, it's 15%, which means that fewer than 1 out of 6 Americans really accepts evolution.
Well, part of it's because they don't understand how it works. I mean, part of it's because they haven't read a book like yours.
Well, no, I don't think it's, I mean, you know, my book was an attempt to change people's minds about evolution by giving them the facts. But in many cases, it just won't work. And I recount a story in the book, if you've read it, you'll know it, where I gave my presentation of the evidence for evolution to a group of, you know, pretty smart and well-off businessmen in the North Shore. And one of them came up to me and shook my hand and said, you know, thanks very much for your talk, Dr. Coyne. I found your evidence very convincing, but I still wasn't convinced.
Yeah, yeah.
And it turned out he was religious.
Yeah.
And so, you know,
I love that because that's right. You can, a lot of times you can lead somebody right to the water. You can show them everything and they just still say, it's great. Still believe in what I believe.
Yeah, and you know, in order to change minds that are that blinkered by faith, you can't just give them people facts. I mean, that's why in my latter years I become more and more sort of anti-religious, because it's religion that really, and this emphasis on this thing called faith, which is really belief without evidence, that has held humanity back so much, I think, and
Really? I mean, don't you think that faith has also contributed a great deal to how we treat one another, to the idea of inspiration, to just the idea, the broad notion that we're all of the same moral worth?
Well, they tell that to the Sunnis and the Shiites. I mean, you know, no, faith has been the divisive, I think, because it's divided. I mean, there's 40,000 sects of Christianity.
And are there really 40,000?
Yeah, there are. It's a figure that was come up by the Gordon Conwell Theological Seminary.
It's a lot of sects.
Even, you know, in Mormonism itself, there's like dozens and dozens of different sects that have all split off, and they all dislike one another. And a lot of the violence and hatred engendered in this world comes from these religious divisions that are completely unnecessary if you don't believe in a God. So yeah, it's clear.
Might also be the fact that human beings are tribal. That might be also the fact that we've evolved to be somewhat tribal.
Well, you know, you can say that. And yeah, we did start off as small tribal bands, and I think we have a sort of xenophobic residuum of that, and that makes us suspicious of strangers. But we've been remarkably able to get over that as we discover that we're not so different from these other people. What keeps us apart is these faiths. You know, I mean, that's what
the idea that one person has a truth that the other person does not.
That is toxic, and especially when those truths are based on revelation and dogma rather than rationality and observation.
That's for sure.
But is that,
so if you think you have the combination of an absolute truth, a religious belief, and your God is telling you what to do and what's right, and that's different from what the person over on the other side is thinking, then, and you think that you have an obligation to set these people right, then that's just a formula for war. I mean, look at the Sunnis and the Shiites. They aren't really tribal. They're ethnically the same.
Yeah.
I mean, that
and it's not a big difference between the Sunni and the Shia, actually, in what they believe. It's kind of like the difference between the Protestants and Catholics, actually less so in some ways.
Yeah, I mean, remember, Protestantism was once, you know, started off as Catholicism.
Yeah, of course. I mean, Martin Luther, you know, I mean, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so I don't think that, I mean, look, I agree that religion has made people do remarkable things, remarkable acts of charity and altruism and things like that. But I also think that we would still have that even if we didn't have religion. And my evidence for that is that if you look at societies, I mean, we're sort of diverging from the evolution topic here, but if you look at societies that are largely a-religious, like those in Northern Europe, Scandinavia, Denmark, and Sweden, those are not hotbeds of immorality or, you know, criminality.
Shucks.
Yeah, I mean, because there's a secular reason. I mean, in the end, you treat people right because of secular reason, not because God tells you to do that.
Because it makes more sense, because it's easier
because,
to get along.
Yeah. You know, if you think that you're doing what's right because God tells you what's right, there's two problems with that. First of all, what if God tells you to kill your own son, like you did with Abraham, then you're going to have to do that.
That's right.
And he started to do it. And
That's right.
Yeah, so that's, you know.
And by the way, and it started to do that, and then God said, you know, stop, but at least you have faith in me. You believe in me enough to kill your own son. You're a good boy.
Yeah.
You know, it was that kind of idea, total devotion and to my authority.
Yeah, and the same with the story of Job, which I just reread recently. I mean, the poor guy suffers his whole lifetime with boils and misery, and his kids getting killed because God just tells him to. And then at the end, God says, well, okay.
Well, you know, it was a competition between the devil and God to see if Job actually had faith, right.
Yes, and the other thing is, you know, do we really want to be moral because we think that there's a celestial policeman that's going to reward us or punish us at the end, or do we want to be moral? I mean, to me, I think Christopher Hitchens called that like a divine North Korea. Or do we want to be, and, you know, there's plenty of secular reasons to be moral. The ancient Greeks, their morality was completely based on secular reason. And so, you know, I mean, we can't prove this, of course, because we can't go back and rerun history without religion. But I would maintain that, you know, we behave, that the amount of malfeasance, of bloodshed, of wars, of hatred and killing would be less if humans had never come up with this idea.
I would disagree with you on that, only because I don't think Genghis Khan or Napoleon had a lot of religious religion, Stalin, Hitler. I mean, a lot of it is just the fact that there's one charismatic leader of a group of people that say, let's go get those resources over there and kill those people.
I mean, people always mention, you know, Stalin and Hitler. By the way, Hitler's regime was not atheistic. It was Christian. They had Gottmittens and their belt buckles and stuff. Like now, ideology serves the same function as religion, a mindless ideology like Stalin.
It is a religion, isn't it? It is a religion.
I mean, you know, look at Stalin. If you read the Gulag Archipelago, you'll see that guy got like 20 years in the Gulag for wrapping a fish in a piece of paper that had Stalin's picture.
That had Stalin's picture on it,
Now, if that's not religion or heresy, I don't know what is.
Yep. Well, and isn't that so much of the mistake that we make is that we assume that religions have to have some supernatural component when, of course, there are many, many secular religions like nationalism and, you know, communism and whatever else.
Yeah, I mean, it all comes down to the thorny problem of what you call religion, which is something I'm wrestling with now as I'm writing a book on this issue. I mean, I would finally define religion as something that entails belief in the supernatural and distinguish that from ideology. But it's both the same thing. I mean, Stalin was, in effect, a god, as was Hitler.
Yep.
And I wouldn't claim for a minute that without religion, the world would be perfect. I mean, there's still bad people. You're still going to get these ideologies. You're still going to have these Hitlers. And you're going to have wars.
But then it seems to me that human beings have natural, like a nostalgia. We've evolved to somehow need some kind of a religion, don't we? I mean, human beings are, with the exception of scientists.
Are you sure it's with the exception of scientists?
Well, you're right. I mean, Newton was very religious. Human beings seem to need religion of some kind. They need to believe in something like an ideology, like a symbol, like
propaganda.
Well,
what
like
about people like me, then, who don't?
Well, people like you are in the minority.
But not just scientists. I mean, if you look at Denmark or Sweden, and you ask, you know, what proportion of the people there believe in God, it's going to be about 15 to 20%. So those societies are largely secular. Those people don't need belief. So if you're going to say people need, and what is the ideology of Denmark, for crying out loud?
Social welfare. They believe, I mean, it's a very communitarian society. I mean, in Denmark, they talk about Jantelagen, which is like Jente's law, which is that nobody is allowed to be better than anybody else.
Yeah.
They have a
communist!
They have a very communitarian ethic. And I think
I think you've hit on something very important there, which is that if you feel taken care of by your society, which is the case in most of Northern Europe, then you don't need religion. I mean, I think that's what Marx was getting at when he said religion is the opium of the people, the sigh of the oppressed masses. It's the thing you turn to when you have nobody else to turn to. And there's the evidence for that is if you look at the health of various societies, there's ways that sociologists measure that. And then correlate that with how religious they are. There's a real negative correlation with the most religious societies being the most dysfunctional. By the way, the U.S. ranks very high on the dysfunctionality scale, which is one reason we don't have national health care. We have high crime rates, incarceration. All of these go into that measure. And sure enough, we're the most religious first world country. But I wouldn't call, what the sort of political systems of Sweden, a religion.
Right.
I mean, if you're going to say that, then you could call anything a religion.
Yeah, they're more practical, they've evolved to be,
Hold on, but I think that's, we had Jonathan Haidt on the podcast, and, he's really studied the experience of religion, right? Mm-hmm. And, essentially what his work comes down to is that religion is a feeling. It's the feeling of transcendence. It's that sense of being lifted out of yourself and becoming a part of a group where you are mindless and you don't think as an individual, If you define it in terms of that feeling, then you actually find that religion is incredibly common. And for example, I would say that the new atheists are actually incredibly religious. Everything that you just said about religion, where you say that my truth is the truth, and they're authoritarian and, insist that you either convert or you're an idiot, could be said of people like Dawkins and Hitchens and that whole crowd. I mean, really what we're dealing with is bigotry and arrogance.
Well, yeah, but at the same time, I think that Dawkins and those guys at least are saying, and certainly Professor Korn is saying, look, science is, you can't call science religion. Science is based on data.
No, you
and
can't
proof
call
and
science. You
that
can't
can
call.
Be, you know.
Yeah, you can't call science religion. The scientific method is not religion. And listen, I was trained as a biochemist. Like, I think that the scientific method is the only way that you can reliably discern how the world works.
Yeah.
But when you then layer on top of that the sort of, you know, I mean, you look at, for example, you know, how your book is written, which I think is beautiful and, you know, is empathetic and sympathetic. You look at how Bill Nye handled the, you know, the evolution debate, where he was saying, listen, it's very simple. If you can show me something that disproves what I'm saying, I will get on board with it right away. That's done with a certain humility.
Right.
As opposed to the rampant arrogance of people like Dawkins, who I think, frankly, I mean, you know, with friends like Dawkins, evolution does not need enemies.
Well,
you know?
I would take issue with that on two grounds. First of all, Dawkins, I think, has done more to promote the acceptance of evolution in this planet than anybody else, despite the fact that he's a vociferous atheist. And the evidence for that is that he has this section of his website called Convert's Corner, where people have written to him, as they write to me occasionally, not so frequently, saying, you know, your book has, and your, you know, has really turned me on to evolution. And by the way, when I, you know, got on board with evolution, I started realizing I didn't need God so much. And I get the same thing. And yet you never, I've never heard a single person say, you know what, if Dawkins would just shut up about atheism, I'd be on board with evolution instantly. So it's not like Dawkins is, you know, vociferous. And he's not really that vociferous, if you know. It's not as if his vociferous, you know, denial of God has turned people away from evolution. Because I've seen not a single person ever express that, as opposed to hundreds of people that say that they've been converted to evolution by Dawkins and away from God. Mm. You know, I mean, and if you're going to talk about arrogance, I mean, what about those theologians that tell me I'm going to go to hell because I don't believe in Jesus?
Of course, they're no better. They're no better.
Well, I think they're, look, the message of Dawkins and Hitchens, I mean, you know, you may not like their expressiveness, but their real message is very simple. There's no, they regard, and this is, I think, the hallmark of New Atheism, to which one that I sign on to. We see religion as a hypothesis about what's true in the world, as many religionists admit. I mean, when you admit that there, when you say there's a God and he sent down his son to die for our sins, and there was Adam and Eve, and we're going to either go to heaven or hell, those are, granted, hard to test propositions, but they're empirical propositions. They're statements about the way the world and the universe really is. And all the new atheists are saying is, okay, where's the evidence for that?
Exactly.
And to say that is perceived as being arrogant, because the whole world is deeply religious, and they get really offended if you ask them, you know, why are you a Christian instead of a Muslim? What's the evidence that your religion is right and Islam is wrong? There's nothing that infuriates.
That's one of my favorite questions to people who are really religious. I always do that to them. I go, well, what makes you think that Jesus Christ, you never met him. I mean, why Jesus?
It's not to say, of course, like, you know, Christianity is a religion about a zombie who's going to save us all, you know? I mean, it's ridiculous on the face of it if you're looking at the facts. But I tutor a bunch of kids who go to Oaks Christian, where they teach that there are four different theories about where the world came from, you know? And I'm saying, it's one thing to have 100 emails that say, you know, you really made me realize I don't realize religion, but you don't understand what's happening on the other side of the coin, where religious fundamentalists are able to, they're not dealing in the facts, they're dealing in emotions, and they're able to point to figures like Dawkins, who are ranting and raving and saying that they're idiots and fools. And I mean, if you look at the quotes that you have on your website, you know, I mean, Richard Dawkins says about your book, I once wrote that anybody who didn't believe in evolution must be stupid, insane, or ignorant. And I was then careful to add that ignorance is no crime. I should now update my statement. Anyone who doesn't believe in evolution is stupid, insane, or hasn't read Jerry Coyne, which is great. Like, that's an amazing review.
That's a pretty good review, man.
Yeah.
I like it.
But at the same time, you know, to simply disparage the other side's intelligence does not.
Well, yeah, I agree that it's not only wrong to do that, because there are plenty of intelligent religious people. But, you know, I think people overrate that. I mean, if you read Dawkins and those people, you don't find many statements like that. I mean, the criticism of Richard by a lot of people and Christopher was by people who never really read their books.
And I have. I mean, I've read The Blind Watchmaker and, you know, I mean, all of those books, you know, I used to love Dawkins. I grew up in England, so I read a lot of his stuff all through high school. And it's great, great writing in the same. But, you know, there's the problem is that because most people have never read those books and they don't read books like yours and they don't understand, they're not going to take the time to really get into the facts.
But they need to.
And exactly.
They need to.
And so they stay at
but
the
they,
place.
But they should be held, their feet should be held to the fire, because I think that that kind of ignorance is destructive at the end of the day. It really is. And I think in the book that you know, you do a very good job of sort of illuminating not only how ignorant most of us are about how evolution works, but also how much just irrefutable evidence there is.
As you just said,
doesn't matter. Sometimes.
People won't accept it if they're religious. So, I mean, my right question would be, okay, you have these people that won't accept evolution, and yet they accept the existence of atoms and germs. How do we bring about their, you know?
Well, explain to us, because you use the word materialistic. It's such a materialistic theory, and it's such an affront to so many people. The idea that we came from the sea, we started as protozoa, and then we were these hominids, you know, these sort of monkeys, and then we branched off somewhere. Talk about the missing link. Explain to us, because you do a great job in the book, what you mean by the missing link. I want to kind of
educate.
Well,
the missing link is something we'll never find for humans and other primates. There's one species way back when of primate whose descendants underwent a splitting event, and all the descendants on one side became the two species of chimpanzees, the bonobos and the regular chimps, and the other descendants became, you know, the various lineages of hominins, figs on the human side, and that would be the single species that split. And, you know, to find that single species is an impossible task.
Why is it impossible?
Oh, because the fossil record is so poor. We know from various calculations that we only know of the existence of anywhere between 1/100% and 1% of all the species that ever lived. Because to be found as a fossil, you have to undergo this very special process of being deposited in water, quickly covered by sediment so your body doesn't get eaten up or dispersed. And then those sediments have to harden and then not be destroyed by the endless churning of the Earth's crust, and they have to be found by paleontologists. Fossils we have were people that fell into water, and there wasn't much water in Africa at that time to have fossil bones, things like that. So to find a fossil is pretty remarkable. But nevertheless, we can document the evolution of humans from our primate ancestors simply because we can find, you know, hominins going back in time, and we can date them with various forms of dating. We can see that the further back in time we go to the time of the common ancestor, which is probably, you know, 5 to 6 million years ago, the more and more ape-like, resemblance we get, and the less and less we look like modern humans.
How many apes... apes/humans have we found? I mean, how many
individual fossils?
Well, in other words, we know Lucy was probably one step along the way.
We have hundreds by now. I mean, you know, there are so many different hominin is the proper word for them now. Hominin.
How does a paleontologist say, well, this just was a type of ape that went extinct? And I should mention beforehand, one of the big problems of creationists is that how do they explain the fact that there is intelligent design that most species, maybe 99% of species, go extinct?
Yeah, and that happened in our lineage too. I mean, the human... And I use the word human, I should say hominin fossil record is very complicated. And in fact, we do not have a complete understanding of our lineage all the way back to the common ancestor. So we have Homo erectus, you know, Paranthropus bosii. We have this new Homo floresiensis, this 3-foot-tall sort of dwarf human called the Hobbit from the island of Flores. And we don't know where that fits in. But what we can show is the further back in time we get, the less modern we look. Our skull gets smaller, our brow ridges get bigger, our teeth get bigger,
have we gotten taller?
Yeah, we have, because Lucy, for example, was, I think, about 3.5 feet tall. And if, you know, so that she'd come up to, you know, your hips. And if you go to the Smithsonian, for example, and look at some reconstructions of these early humans, they're remarkably small.
What about Cro-Magnon, though? Wasn't Cro-Magnon...
That's not a term that's used so much anymore. It was about our size. By the time we got up to the Neanderthals, we were pretty much about our present height.
You know? So Neanderthals were broader and much stronger than we were, weren't they?
Well, they were stockier, and they probably went extinct, but we have genetic remnants of them left kicking around. I mean... Obviously, there were several lineages of humans, of Neanderthals were one, and they bred with the lineage that became us, the modern humans. And so there are some populations that have Neanderthal genes kicking around them. How do we know that? Because we can sequence the genome of Neanderthals, which is one of remarkable advances.
Are those people typically more muscular, or do we know? Or
No. It would just be a very, very small percent, like 1 or 2% of your genes would be Neanderthal. And as far as I know, there's no sort of morphological traits that they have that would make them look any different from modern humans, because
right.
it's such a small percentage. But it did show that, you know, we had a remarkably complex family tree. And we could have, I mean, at some times in Africa, there were probably 4 or 5 different species of hominins existing in the same time and probably around the same place. And it's fascinating to think, well, maybe they encountered each other. What did they think of each other? You know, most of them went extinct. In fact, all of them but one, because we descend back to a single lineage. But at one time, we were a branching bush. And we
can prove genetically that we all came from Africa?
Yeah, there's no doubt about that. And we know pretty much when, about 60,000 years ago, one group of Africans left and then spread throughout the world. And that, you know, 60 to 100,000 years ago or so. It's remarkable the reconstructions we can do.
Well, what about this? What about this theory of the aquatic ape?
I'm not a real expert in that, but, you know, the people I trust who know these things, anthropologists, don't have a lot of credence in that theory. You know, for one thing, Africa was not admired in lakes and sea at that time. I mean, you can adduce that because of things like the way a hair and our arms go, but it's not really very convincing.
Well, what is the theory, anyway, of the aquatic age?
Well, the humans, you know, that many of the human features evolved because we were spent most of our time in the water, I believe, catching fish and stuff. But again, you know, the evidence is all against that. We were mostly a terrestrial organism, lived in the savannah, and we show lots of features of that, ranging from, you know, the way our bodies evolved to be upright runners. We're not swimmers.
Yeah.
A lot of us can't even swim, which you'd think would be instinctual if we evolved in the water. Plus, we had tool using. We were hunting on land, things like that. Fire using, which is thought by many people like Dick Wrangham at Harvard to be critical in human evolution. In fact, he thinks fire was the feature that made our brains big and distinctly human, the ability to evolve those brains because we had this source of protein now that freed us from having to, you know, restrictions on brain size. We don't know if that's true, but that's just some of the fascinating speculations. But there's very little evidence that we evolved in the water at all. I mean, everything we know goes against that. So
even though there's no real evidence about it, it's still popular on the internet.
Well, yeah, but so is Bigfoot, and so are UFOs,
exactly.
And,
yeah.
You know, anti-vaccinations. I mean, the internet is a lousy place to get...
to get your truth by revelation.
Well, except if you go to the right website.
Yeah,
it's a really good place to learn science if you find the right places.
Give us some websites for science.
Well, at the end of my book, you know, I'm not going to try to sell my book. Readers can
we are
it or not,
we are.
Yeah, okay.
But your book is it's important to read.
Yeah, at the end of the book, there's a section called Further Resources, and there's a subsection in that called Websites, and which lists some very reliable websites. One of them is run by the University of California at Berkeley, for example. The Smithsonian has a very good website for human evolution where you can go, and they're very interactive. They're a lot of fun to see, and they're quite instructive. So I have a lot of friends who are internet fanatics, and they happen to like science, and they've learned, you know, a lot of stuff, much more than the average layperson would learn.
You have a great section in the book where you basically point to how many vestigial traits human beings have.
Mm-hmm.
Vestigial meaning, for anybody listening, the idea that there are leftover parts we no longer use that our ancestors did. For example, the fact that we create goosebumps, that we have goosebumps when we get scared or cold, that is what animals do when they have fur, when they're either afraid, their fur stands on end, or it gets cold, their fur stands on
end.
We also have a vestigial tail. Some children, in fact, are born with a tail with muscles and fur and blood vessels. It's easily lopped off, but clearly a fetus...
And the most obvious example is the appendix.
Right.
Right.
Yeah, although, you know, creationists are making a big fuss about that. The appendix does have a sort of some function. There's some parts of a tissue which produce components of the immune system. So they can say, well, it does something, so it's not vestigial. But the problem is that a vestigial trait could do something and still be vestigial.
Right.
You know, I mean, the penguins, you can think of them as having vestigial wings, but they actually use those wings for a purpose. They fly underwater with them.
Yeah.
But that does not mean that penguins were not descended from flighted birds.
Well, whale,
we know they did.
Yeah, whales do not use their feet that are obviously in their body. Right?
Yeah. So, yeah. I mean, to me, some of the most remarkable vestigial traits are the ones that we've revealed since we started sequencing the human genome. And we find that we have all these genes in our bodies that don't do anything. They've been rendered inactive by mutation. But their presence there can only be explained because they were active in some of our relatives or ancestors. And one of the ones I use in the book is the yolk proteins, that the human fetus does not feed on yolk like, you know, reptiles do or amphibians. We feed from the placenta of the mother. And yet if you sequence the human genome, you'll find that there are three genes for making egg yolk protein that are silenced. They've been silenced by mutation. So how it is a creation is going to explain the presence in our genome of genes to make yolk.
And not only that, what about viruses that have been long dormant? You have a section about that.
Yeah, retroviral insertions in humans that are in the same place as chimpanzees, obviously inserted a virus infected our common ancestor, one of them, and became inactive because we're constantly having these things come into our genome as parasites, and we have ways of getting rid of them, but their DNA is still there. And if you look at chimps and humans, you'll find that, you know, and other species as well, like gorillas, you'll find that we have these silent parasitic insertions at the identical places in our genome. And, you know, how can you explain that under any other hypothesis but evolution? I mean, so this is just, you know, a very small part of the evidence. It doesn't have anything to do with fossils, doesn't have anything to do with biogeography, doesn't have anything to do with
embryology
or anything else. The remarkable thing about evolution is that there are so many different areas of biology that point to very disparate areas like biogeography and DNA. I mean, how different can you get from, you know, the distribution of plants and animals on the surface of the planet to the DNA sequence of those things? And yet they both point to the, you know, conclusion that things evolved. And it's that sort of confluence of evidence that makes such a strong case for the truth of evolution.
Well, I was just going to say, and it ends up making for a fascinating story. Like the story, yeah. I mean, it's a much more interesting story to see how over billions of years, you know, continents collided, they broke apart, you know, species got trapped and isolated, and so they evolved to that environment. I mean, it's endlessly fascinating. And you have that great quote in the beginning from Darwin, just about, you know, the experience that, you know, I mean, because he's writing in the Victorian era and he's a little bit paternalistic.
Yes,
he says the naked savage has upon seeing a ship, as opposed to the experience that, you know, a person who understands the ship has in looking at it.
Mm. Yeah, and it's what's really frustrating for somebody like me who shares that wonder is that that half of Americans are just, you know, won't accept it, period. They'd rather accept mythological stories.
It's very humbling to accept it. It's scary. It's humbling, the idea that there's nothing that there's sort of no giant benevolent force. You know, human beings like to enter contracts. If I do this, then I'm going to get this reward. I do it all the time. We all do it. And it's really hard to be a tiny rowboat in the middle of a giant ocean, and that's kind of how it feels sometimes. You know, science is such a magnificent, wonderful, and wondrous thing, and I think a lot of people, to be fair to creationists, a lot of people are scientific for the most part. So a lot of people are very scientific, and they have no problem believing that science is very important, that the new frontiers of science are going to create a great world for us, a scary world in some cases, but for the most part, there are a lot of people, I think the majority of people are, that 46%, are scientifically minded in, or at least accepting, not minded, but scientifically, they accept the general principles of science.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Except they tend to go, well, with evolution, how do you explain this incredible, wondrous thing called a soul that I feel like I have. I don't want to live in a world that's just purely, you know, mathematical and biological. I want to believe that there's something, I don't know, a plan. There's a plan.
Yeah.
I feel that way sometimes.
Yeah, I know. And, you know, I mean, I can completely sympathize with that attitude. I mean, I don't want to die, you know. I don't want to die. I mean, I'd like to live forever if I could, but you got to recognize the truth, because I think it's only if when you know the truth about things that you can really tackle them appropriately. I think it was Voltaire who said something like, you know, the fact that you want something is no, does not go one iota towards proving that that something really exists.
Yeah.
So we have to get, I mean, it's, I think even the Bible says this, that, you know, when you're a child, you play with childish things, and when you grow up, you put away your childish things and become a man. And I think that's, you know, what religion basically is, although it's sort of ironic that this is in the Bible. Religion was useful in a time when we did not understand how the world worked.
Yeah.
You know, when we wanted to explain where thunder and lightning came from and what, where humans went when they died and things like that. But, you know, science started explaining that stuff, and that means it's time to put our toys back in the toy chest. And, you know,
well, the scientific method, we had William Bernstein on, who wrote The Four Pillars of Investing and The Birth of Plenty and a number of other books. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, one of the reasons that the West was able to surpass many other cultures was you know, things like property rights and things, but also mainly the scientific method. The idea that you had to have empirical evidence before you drew a conclusion, and that required the analysis of data.
Yeah, that's true. It's a big argument amongst historians of science why science is a modern phenomenon and arose uniquely in the West. I mean, there was science being done in China, and there was science being done in
Well, there are a lot of, I mean, Jared Diamond, we also had on the podcast, and he wrote that great book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, about that, and William Bernstein has tackled that. There are some great books written on exactly why the rise of nations, and some great books written on that stuff.
There was scientific activity in these other places, but the scientific method wasn't really formalized until, you know, in Europe.
Yeah. Yeah, although, you know, I would take issue with the statement that we have a formalized scientific method. I mean, I think what you mean is that the habit of doing science, the way, you know, the reliance purely on naturalism and empiricism and materialism is arose in the West. Because, you know, when I tried to explain in the book I'm writing about what the scientific method was, I realized there wasn't any. It's basically anything goes, but you have to adhere to certain principles. Like, you have to use reason, you have to test your theories against nature, you know, you have to doubt constantly, you have to have consensus. I mean, there are certain guidelines for how to do science, but the way the scientific method is described in the textbooks is not the way that we really do science,
per se.
It's just that the sort of the culture and the habit caught on in Europe, and I don't think that historians of science are in agreement on why that is the case. Some say it's because the Enlightenment arose in Europe, but then that just pushes the problem back another notch. And some people say, well, religion, you know, suppressed science, you know, for so many years. Other people make the opposite claim that, you know, science is an outgrowth of religion, that the idea that God had certain laws and principles that scientists were set out to discover, which Newton, I think, thought of. And people argue back and forth about that. And
well, let me ask you something. I mean, you know, I like to change minds. I think everybody does. What is, if somebody says I don't believe in evolution, can you give me five things I can say to them to change their minds?
Well, it depends on, well, first of all, they should be saying I don't accept evolution.
Right.
Because belief is sort of implies faith, but let's leave that aside. It depends on why they don't accept it. I mean, if it's because their religion tells them that it's wrong, or that, you know, there's inimical consequences of accepting evolution, like you become immoral, which is something that a lot of Americans believe will happen, then there's nothing you can do. I mean, it was like that guy in the North Shore. I could talk till I was blue in the face, and he would never, you know, accept evolution. If somebody has a truly open mind, you could just show them stuff. You could ask them about the vestigial genes in humans. You could show them the fossil record. There was a show I participated in by the BBC, I believe. It was called Creationist Road Trip, where they took five creationists and took them around the States from one scientist to another, you know, seeing how they'd react to evidence. And the thing that you know, I talked to them about Noah's Ark and made no headway at all. Trying to tell them that you can't fit 7 million species on a boat. That's 300 feet long. They just, you know, said, well, God could have made the animals small. Or that was kinds and not species.
Yeah, that's an impossible thing to
argue
with.
Yeah, but the thing that really, really changed, well, you know, made them most discomforted is they went to Berkeley, and Tim White laid out in order of time the skulls of many of our relatives and ancestors, all the way back from 4 million years Australopithecine to modern humans. And when you see those things arrayed, they're not put in order just, you know, to make it look like evolution. They're put in order because they're dated, and so we know what order they actually came in. They had a hard time with that. So, you know, so probably the first thing I would do if I wanted to convince somebody that didn't believe in evolution.
Pull out a bunch of skulls.
Pull out a bunch of human skulls and hominin skulls. Put them in order and just say, okay, how do you explain this?
Yeah.
And the Smithsonian website would be a great place to do
that. Yeah, that's the place you want to go to actually see those skulls, because they have them laid out. They have the putative family trees and stuff, and it is remarkably convincing.
We had John Gerchy on the podcast who did most of the paleo art behind that Smithsonian Hall.
Yeah, it's a really, really good place. Yeah. I just visited a couple of years ago for the first time and was quite impressed by the thing, even though I think it was largely funded by the Koch brothers, whose politics I'm not really down with. But nevertheless, it's one of the best things in the Smithsonian, and you can't walk away from there if you have an open mind.
If you besides your book, which again is Why Evolution is True, by Professor Coyne, but besides your book, if you could have Americans read, so let me just say it again. Why Evolution is True by Jerry Coyne. Great book, and this is what the book we're talking about. Besides that book, if you could make all people read 5 books, what would they be?
And they don't have to be about evolution. They can be any topic.
You mean, but scientific topics? Or?
They can be scientific. I don't know, Brian. What's your intent with the question?
I don't even know what my question is. I literally was like, you know what? I'm going to ask him this question.
Well, let's stick to science, just because, you know, actually the 5 books website, and there is such a website, asked me that question: which 5 books would I recommend on evolution for the average person? And you could Google that. I guess I don't even remember what they were, but you know, I would definitely recommend reading On the Origin of Species by Darwin. I mean, it is the one work of science that is A, accessible to the public, and B, is absolutely shows you how a revolution in human thought can come about, you know, in just 400 pages. It's a tough slog in some places, but, you know, well, I mean, any person that has the pretenses to call themselves educated should read On the Origin of Species, I think. Mm. It's like reading Newton, but Newton is a hard slog.
Yeah, that's a hard slog.
Principia Mathematica doesn't
I even looked at that. And, I mean, that's like the Ulysses of science. You know, it's a book that you want to have read but can't get through. Carl Sagan's Demon Haunted World is a book that I'm quite fond of. I mean, Sagan was a wonderful writer, and it's a book about how science is done. You know, and how it differs from superstition. He has a chapter on what he calls the baloney detection kit, how you tell real science from pseudoscience.
I love it.
It conveys the wonder of the scientific endeavor in great detail. So we, you know, definitely recommend that, you know. Those are science books. Other books that are on evolution, you know, Richard Dawkins, who doesn't seem to be well liked here, wrote a book called The Greatest Show on Earth, which came out about the same time as mine, which is also an evidence for evolution book, and it's very different from mine. But, you know, if I was going to recommend one Dawkins book to read for the average reader that would be accessible and would enhance their sense of wonder, it would be The Blind Watchmaker. You know, it's not his favorite book. He likes the extended phenotype, but that's a book for scientists. The Blind Watchmaker is a book about natural selection and how it works. And
we're definitely going to try to get him on the podcast, by the way.
Yeah, that book, there's parts of it that are pure poetry. I mean, when he's at his best in writing well and writing lyrically, there's nobody that can match him today. And that book, I think, is is a masterpiece. You know?
And you actually, I have up here the five books that you recommend, and in both cases you recommended The Blind Watchmaker.
Yeah, I can't remember. What are the other, and of course, The Origin of Species would be one.
Yeah, The Origin of the Species by Charles Darwin. You've got Ever Since Darwin by Stephen Jay Gould.
Oh, yeah, Gould's essays, yes. So.
And then you also have Evolution by Donald Prothero. Mm-hmm. And Charles Darwin by Janet Brown.
Yeah, I would, you know, if you're, those are for, I mean, there. I was asked about evolution specifically. Brown's two-volume biography is magnificent. So if you want to learn about Darwin, what his life was like, how he came to his theories, what kind of person he was, Brown's book is by far the best. The Prothero book, which is about the fossil evidence for evolution, is a bit more technical. So, you know, I would...
Well, either way, the evidence is out there, you know, and your book does a great job of, you know, I learned as much as I need to know. I mean, that's not true, but I mean, I learned a lot with the book. So that we're going to put that up on our website. It's called Why Evolution is True by Jerry Coyne. And we can't thank you enough for joining us on the podcast, man.
Sure.
I mean,
my pleasure.
You make a difference, honestly. And I can't wait to read your next book.
It'll be a while, maybe 2 years at the most.
That's what happens
we're
when
patient.
you're a thinking man, my friend. When you're a thinking man, you got to be careful with everything you do. And but you did a great job with your first book, so I can't wait to see the second one.
Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on.
Well, thanks for doing what you do, man. Keep shouting and keep writing because we
take
need
care.
You. We need you.
All right, take care and bye.
Thank you, sir.
Bye bye.
Good stuff.
Great stuff.
Yes, sir. Jerry Coyne, Why Evolution is True. I think everybody should read that book.
It's a great book.
At least read part of it. You can get it on Audible. Download it. That's what I did. I just listened to it.
And Dawkins' The Blind Watchmaker is also a great companion piece to that as well.
I got to read that. I haven't read it.
It's very good.
Let's try to get him on.
Yes,
Hunter?
We can.
And all right, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. Oh, we'll get him on and you know.
And you'll go battle him.
Yeah. No, I mean, I just think that's the point is, listen, you know, Darwin was writing over 150 years ago, and we're still having this argument, and we haven't really moved forward. And essentially, you know, Aldous Huxley was the Richard Dawkins of the, you know, 1800s, and he screamed and shouted about how, you know, religious people were idiots. And I just think that screaming and shouting at people and telling them they're idiots is about the least effective way to win
them
over.
I'm also religious. I don't know what I'm religious about, but I just like to live in a world where I believe in something other than science. And I don't know what it is, but I do.
And remember Jonathan Haidt, when he did a study of who used the most certainty words, it was Fox News and the New Atheists.
There you go, ladies and gentlemen.
So, I mean...
And the debate continues.
Yeah.
Hunter Motz.
You've been listening to The Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy. And follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.